Thank you very much, Mark, and thanks to all of you, because I have read lots and lots of papers, and it has been extremely helpful. And so I don't think that the scientists that are in here who publish the papers very frequently get thanked for their contributions. I have been working on this. The idea showed up around 2002, and in 2004 I built an indoor vertical farm using HPS in Marathon, New York, in the basement of a canoe factory, a Grumman canoe factory, and that was a pretty exciting time for me. What you'll see in my presentation is a far cry from the days of HPS, and I would say rather crude, if you will, almost a Rector set type approach to things. I thought about today's presentation and thought that it might be useful to guide you through at least what was my thinking over the last dozen years or so in the process of trying to make this into a reality. And you can imagine here, I guess very recently in Sigma Xi notes, I saw that they've decided that 23,000 years ago we began agriculture as opposed to 10, and that was on the discovery of scarified seeds. And you can imagine even then perhaps people thought someone who was organizing agriculture instead of just going out and picking things might be a crazy person with some rather difficult and perhaps foreign ideas. And then, you know, about 1,000 years ago, we domesticated animals and used those to help us with agriculture. And I can also imagine at that time people were told, wow, you're crazy. Why would you take a cow and try to harness them to accomplishing something like this? And 100 years ago, and I've read some newspaper articles about the impact of tractors on using horses, there were a lot of people who made some very unkind statements about the use of tractors and the demise of the horse population and how fertilizer was going to go away. And there were it was just very intriguing reading to get through in terms of what happens when technology shifts. And now we're up to the point of where much of the time the harvesting is assisted by lots of other fancy equipment. There are even grape and berry pickers that go down the rows and pull the fruit off and collect it. This is where I've arrived. This picture is a couple of weeks old. We planted a week ago, and this is in downtown Newark, New Jersey. It's not very far from Penn Station, Newark, in the Ironbound section. Actually, our R&D facility is not in this particular building, and we are building a much larger facility about four or five blocks from this particular one. What you're looking at is the side view of a stacked machine, which I'll explain how it works in a moment, but it has seven levels to it, seven levels of growing. It's 80 feet long and it's 5 feet wide. There's actually another machine behind this one, and there's one that will be grown once we learn enough from these two to make sure that we're on the right track with to be able to build more of them and eventually perhaps fill this entire building. So this is how the machine works. It kind of has two zones. The upper one is lit with LED lights. And then there's space for air so that we can get carbon dioxide to the plants and remove oxygen and humidity. And then there's a lower zone, and there's spray nozzles there that spray the roots with a nutrient solution. It's a closed system, so at the very bottom there's a reservoir that's used to recycle the nutrient solution. And we maintain that reservoir in the bottom by doing at least weekly nutrient samples and testing so that we know what we're deficient in. we've become reasonably smart at this, so we're able to predict what's happening by knowing what's growing. the cloth that's in between is something that we hold a patent on. Actually, we have a second patent on it, pending, and worldwide rights pending as well. And the cloth is kind of a unique substance that prevents the nutrients from getting on the plants, which is something that you don't want to have happen no matter what your hydroponic approach is. And the cloth is a suitable medium for the roots to go down through, and it has been working very well. It's where I started in 2004. So part of this was, for me, I'm really actually a dairy scientist who got transplanted, as Mark said, to an administrator at Cornell, and then I've had a fascinating career, which I'd love to share with you, but not today, and something exciting, and I'm very happy to be in plants. It's a much softer place to be rather than with animals, but I wondered, raise your hand if you think that sunlight's free. Okay, I hope when I'm done you'll realize. Okay, I hope when I'm done that you realize that sunlight really is not free. But here's what we typically look at photosynthesis as being made up. And what I want to do is take a different lens and look at it and try to imagine how it could be done differently, how it could be done in a much more controlled way, and how it could be done much less expensively, or at least try to reduce the expenses of the typical situation. So with light, it doesn't come when we want it, but if we apply it artificially, we can really control it and supply it exactly on time. It doesn't come in the amount that we want. So with our electric light, we can do it in the exact amount that we want. It's not always the spectrum we want. And when I say we, I'm being anthropomorphizing here. I have a close affinity for plants anymore, so take the interpretation that I'm really talking about plants. But also, lots of heat or cold, depending upon the exposure that you have when you try to use sun. So you're always trying to remediate the temperature situation. And if you use proper construction techniques, you can mediate a great deal of what of those expenses. Frequently, because of the way you have to put things together, greenhouses and or just being outside, you have lots of dust, bugs, rodents, birds, all kinds of things. Whereas if you have an indoor environment, you can remove all of those potential sources of contamination and produce a product that's ready to eat without washing it. So, is it free? Well, it's not free. But then what is less expensive? And I'm not going to claim at the moment that LED lights are less expensive, but in the end, it's what the total COGS are for growing. And I'll speak a little bit to that in a bit. But right now, LED lights is a great place to be because the cost of them is going down and the efficiency of them is going up. And at this point, we're at about 100 watts per lumen. We don't use lumens, but that's when you're out in the marketplace, that's kind of the metric that's used. And and that's become a very helpful aspect to developing the COGS. Media, if you look at the soil, it's not always the right pH, and across the field, it's going to vary. Whereas in our nutrient solution, we can control the pH, and that helps us with the availability of all of the nutrients that we have there. When you spread fertilizer outside, it can run off or or create salinization. It's a bit more under control in hydroponic systems in general. But if you have a closed circuit, you can use, and this is just pretty gross estimate, it'd be real fun to see just exactly what happens, but you can use about half the amount of fertilizer. That's our estimate. The roots in a soil system have to seek the inputs that they want. So when they become stressed, they spend more energy on creating that biomass in order to find the nutrients. We deliver them, so it's like putting the plant in a hotel, and it gets room service all the time. When you have soil, usually you have to wash the product. It's pretty hard to grow something that's ready to eat outside. Or if you do and you sell it that way, then it's up to the consumer to do the washing part of things. But here, no wash, straight into the bag or the clamshell or whatever you're using as a container, and it's ready to eat. With hydroponics, you have other things like single-use parts, rock wool. Our cloth we use for years. Not enough oxygen in some cases, depending upon how you manage your hydroponic system and what kind it is. Here with an aeroponic system, there's no need to mess with that. Looking at a third component, the atmosphere, ambient outdoor is about 400 ppm. When you have a closed indoor system, and if you think about this, if you can manage the temperature and the humidity without much exchange of outside air, then CO2 supplementation really becomes quite possible, and it's fairly easy to maintain. And an interesting anecdote, we noticed huge spikes because our office, our current R&D facility is in an old nightclub, and we noticed these huge spikes in CO2 content, and we started matching it to how many people showed up to work. So it's quite amazing how much CO2 an individual turns out. Okay, so and it, you know, the atmosphere when you're growing in other things is not the right temperature, humidity, as was mentioned before, but in a more closed system, you can keep those right where you want them. And I've talked about the dust, no dust in our product. Okay, and the ambient greenhouse, it's expensive CO2 supplementation exhausted to the outdoors. I know that there are trade-offs, and it's used in the Netherlands, probably quite efficiently, but it's quite inexpensive for us to do this in our system. So the benefits that are realized are clean, pristine, consistent crops. And if you try to do a long-term contract with a retailer, that's what you have to have. That's how you get a good price for your product, because they don't like the way farming currently works. Sometimes they have it, sometimes they don't. They would really like to keep populating their shelves and not have to go to the expense of changing all of the other aspects of their part of the chain. When you have this kind of setup, our typical growth cycle is 16 to 18 days, and so that gives you 22 to 30 crops. The higher ones are for microgreens, and that gives you a lot of learning opportunities. So as compared to two or three times outside, you learn your mistakes. Here we learn our mistakes, and we have lots more opportunities to work with it. We're able to take each one of those machines and customize them then to the particular cultivars. So as that data comes in and we know exactly what we need to do to optimize various conditions, we're able to tweak those in order to optimize overall production. And this is something I never would have believed a dozen years ago. I was sure that I would have to get a premium. I'd have to be similar to the organic industry, et cetera. I would have to have some way in which I could get a much higher price for my crop. That no longer is a difficulty for us. We're cost competitive with the field-grown crops, and we know this because we have quite a few friends in the field-grown industry who have shown interest in what we're doing. The flavor is managed here, and that's also really important because some of the cultivars that were used outside and did not produce, let's say, something like arugula, pepperiness was an issue for the Astro variety, so everybody went to Wild Rocket. well, you can produce Astro with the same level of pepperiness as you have with Wild Rocket, and you get better yields as from it as well. So there's some considerations in terms of flavor because of the level of control. And we have a lot of sensors now. We have a system that keeps track of what's going on, and there's about each one of our 30 by 60 flats with the cloth on it, we end up with thousands of data points from each crop that we harvest, or each time we harvest. Some other benefits: it's an improved working environment. And we're hiring people who have never seen green things grow, and so it's really a pleasure to see what happens on their face. Some of them, though, it's hard to convince to eat green leafy stuff, especially if they're younger, and I think that's something that in the future we need to look at some research. If we're able to manipulate these crops in this way, then why do young people choose not to eat green stuff? I think it tastes great. Everybody in the company except for two people, okay, think it's great stuff. The rest of them are willing to make salads on Mondays and Wednesdays when the whole company gets together and we have salad at noon, okay, but they'll sit there and they'll have their McDonald's or whatever else and they'll make the salad, but they won't eat it. Okay, we're located in urban areas. We're demonstrating that in Newark. We have other projects underway as well. Existing structures can be used in this. So our R&D facility is in an old nightclub. It has the lights. They don't work. We've shut them off, but we could turn on things, you know, that put sparkly lights all over the place, and the walls are all painted up with really interesting stuff. And then to keep the trend going, the one that I showed you in the beginning, that's an old paintball place where people can, you know, go in and play paintball games, and they decorated the walls with different parts of the world, okay, so that you can, so the ambiance in there is following the same trend, and it's kind of a fun thing that's going on. So we haven't yet decided what to do with the third facility in Newark, but I'm sure we'll come up with some really good ideas as to how to decorate that one. Existing structures sometimes can be difficult, but I think this is something that makes vertical farming interesting and helpful to a community, is you're going to take an awful lot of empty buildings. We have so many empty buildings, and using them is I think a real positive thing. The space is maximized, so we do about 75 times what outdoor growing does by having the levels and the number of crops. So if you multiply those, you can come up with your own number depending upon what assumptions you're making, anywhere from 75 to 100 times as much growing space. Project capital right now, this is a hot space to be in. Vertical farming, there's a great deal of interest from venture capital and from others. If you can prove that the concept works, then project capital is much less expensive than venture capital, and so you can move ahead. Disintermediation of the current channels, obviously a lot lower transportation costs as opposed to bringing things in from the Salinas Valley or San Juan, any of those areas where things are grown. And you get a longer shelf life from the customer's point of view because you've taken those transportation days out. And with that many crops, we're very responsive to the customer's needs. So if the customer comes and says, we want to shift to some other crop, we're not anywhere near as locked in as other people are with such short crop cycles. So So that's the view, if you will. That's sort of the way it looked at things and tried to analyze each aspect of it and try to say, okay, if I'm an engineer and I understand a little bit about plants, and I'm still very much learning about plants, especially plants and light, how to look at it differently and try to push each one of those elements to the point of where we can produce a crop and do it economically. There are still challenges left, and these challenges would be something that people in this room, I hope, would take some interest in. We'd really like to have more objective ways or measurements of organoleptic properties. So right now, you can do texture type things. You can measure the color. Those are sort of the easy ones. But getting into the real physiology of what does it taste like? How do we measure pepperiness? How do we measure other aspects? Do we even know why people select things, and then more importantly, why they come back and eat them again? How do we measure that connection between the physiology of the plant that we've managed or created as a result of having this kind of control, and what are the factors that allow people to choose things? So the color, the shape, the petioles, all of those things are important. When you put things in a bag, taste, crunch is very important in the leafy green area. How do we manage that? And one of the challenges that was brought up the other day here, and something that we're being approached to look at is our current crops are all, the genetics are focused on bugs, shipping viability, all the things that to some degree we don't care about anymore. What we would really care about is all those things that I put under organoleptic properties. So how can we breed new crops that will bring more customers to us because they like greens, they want to increase that in their diet, and they want to learn it when they're young. There's also shelf life, which somewhat relates to this. How can we objectively determine, and we're looking at vision systems and whole bunches of other things, but how can we determine when the shelf life is unacceptable to the customer? How can we predict that? So many of these things we're talking about, plants seem to have some characteristics very early in the game that tell you what they're going to be later on. And some of that is part of our learning here. So how can we predict that the shelf life is this and maybe put a date on there and say, you know, you got to eat it by then? Although we don't tend to have that problem, not even at our place. It seems to go much faster than we can produce it. The challenges in the automation area, I guess when I first started this, I had more of a conveyor belt kind of thing, and I thought that perhaps that would lead me to a way to automate the process. I think if you look across all the ways that people have been putting their systems together, it's not just about whether you can grow the plant, but it's whether or not you can cost-effectively harvest it, put your equipment back into use, meet all the requirements that you have for food safety, for OSHA, all those other things. Are all those considerations captured in the farm system that you put together? And those involve the harvesting, cleaning, and packaging. I never would have imagined when I started out, and I was very lucky, I just got U-line, Ziploc bags. I guess you can't call them Ziplocs if you buy them from U-line, but, you know, I got that kind of bags, and I really lucked out because the respiration rate that was built into that polypropylene and the number of mils that I got actually worked very well for the products that I was shipping, but I had no idea that that was what was going on. There's a great deal more sophistication to proper packaging and managing respiration rates. And that seemed to me also when we got consultants and we used UC Davis's post-harvest information that's a science that isn't quite perfected, and it's certainly not farmer friendly. So thank you very much. Appreciated being able to share kind of where Arrow Farms is. Yes, Ray.
It looks like you have an aeroponic system.
Yes.
Your approach, and if the trays are movable,
Yeah, so if I don't, let's say, get exuberant about answering the question, it's because we're doing something in a competitive environment. But yes, we are using an aeroponic system. The trays, they're 30 by 60. They're covered with the cloth. It's stretched on those frames, and they are interlocked. They're interlocked for a couple of reasons, to keep the nutrients from coming up through, and also to allow you to pull the trays forward, because our method is to harvest on one end and seed on the other end. Yeah. Yes. Yes, Gia. What you do is you get the prospective buyer in, and you put a whole table of stuff in front of them, and you have them pass it around and make the determination. And it's fun to watch the expressions on their face when they try something and they thought they knew what it was going to taste like before they put it in their mouth. So that's pretty much how we make that decision. It is balanced by what we can grow well. So, if they ask us to come up with figs, okay, we're probably not going to do that. So it's really, what can we grow? What can we grow profitably as a matchup to that? But, you know, there's so many leafy greens, a couple hundred of them that I've grown so far, not all of which I've grown successfully, but it's just a case of learning how to germinate, learning how, what environment they need in order to grow. We have so many opportunities that usually it's not a hard matchup to make between what you can grow and what they want. Yes, Carrie?
Could you please comment a little bit on the economics of this and break-even times? And the reason I'm asking is a lot of us get asked all the time by would-be entrepreneurs who want to get into the vertical farming industry, but they're intimidated by the infrastructure, the equipment cost, the electric bill, the equipping the lamps for the lighting and all, and then getting over the hurdles of learning the technology. What works? What's viable for a startup in terms of automation and to become economically viable? Can you make any comments on this at all?
Could you repeat the question?
Sure, yes, sorry. So the question really is for a startup person, what's viable? And Carrie, I hate to say this, but I can't share those things. My colleagues have sort of said that's not something that I can share as the direct costs. Okay. Yes, right. So you can always ask a question. You're going to get a yes or a no, but there's no cost in it. Absolutely. I will share this much. There's a lot of people who are saying that lighting is expensive. Okay, expensive compared to what? I don't like those statements. That's not useful. It's not helpful to people who are trying to look at this. You actually need to look at what does it cost you to get the light to where you want it. You need to pay attention to the spectrum. You need to pay attention to the intensity that you're looking for. You need to pay attention to who the manufacturer is, because there's a lot of crap out there. And we have a person who's been using LEDs for well over a dozen years on our staff as an engineer who understands and can speak the entire diode language, which is extremely helpful when you're trying to do this to get them at low cost and get exactly what you want. So at the moment, I guess it's about a third of the cost. About a third of the cost is packaging, which is surprising, and I think a lot of people aren't prepared for that, and a third of the cost is the rest of it. So that's as close as I can get to answering your question. I think it is very difficult for a startup to get there. I have great partners. I have we have a CEO who's very good at raising funds, a CMO who has a great deal of experience in marketing, especially in this area. So startups need to have a whole team of people. When I was trying to be all of those things at once, I was not successful. And adding those individuals has made us successful. Yes, other questions? Yes, sir.
I guess you deal on these two questions.
you said that you can grow several different kinds of microgreens and depends on the customer want to eat. And then you also said 1/3 of the cost comes from lining. My question is, do you have any system on your pods that can adjust the lights from these different crops, or that fixed system that runs all the same to any kind of different crops?
Yeah, so the question is how to manage light relative to crop. Yes, to bring the price down. I've heard some very interesting approaches to things here in which, you know, the light intensity or essentially the energy that's put in might be managed relative to the particular crop and its needs, and also perhaps the stage of a particular crop might be also responsive to that kind of approach. Here, it's a fixed system and things move down, but we have the opportunity to change the lighting in each one of those levels to match what we want. And it's really not pots. There are no pots. The seeding is done directly to the cloth. The roots work their way down through the cloth and make themselves available to the nutrient system. Yes, sir. Yes, so we have a couple of people who spend quite a bit of time looking at what the electrical price structure is. We're quite a ways down the road with something in Buffalo so that we can take advantage of Niagara power. We have other approaches to renewables or energy from cogeneration kind of approaches. So we're very aware if it's a third of your COGS, you're going to pay a lot of attention to how you get it and how you push that cost down. I think this is a real cool aspect of this, that by using electricity as an input like this, with all of the emphasis on trying to improve our response, our environmental responsibility, our reducing our cost, making things just kind of better in that whole environment. It's great that we're using electricity as that significant input. If we were tied to other fuels, then I think it would be even more difficult. So electricity makes it really very flexible. Yes, sir. Okay, so the question is, what's the price of electricity in Newark?
Yeah, for the each kilowatt hour, how much like that?
It's about 10 cents. Yep. Other places it can go down to 6, and in some cases, investigation has shown as low as 4. Of course, you don't know how long that will last, but yes. Yes, sir.
My question, you talked about the importance of labor to your buyers.
Mm-hmm.
Are those same buyers focused on nutritional quality? If you could actually quantify it and provide it consistently, do you think that they would pay a higher price for or anything that would have a higher nutritional value, whether it's nutrients or phytonutrients?
It's sort of a yes and no, and I think the court's kind of out on exactly what that is. Most of the consumers don't walk up in the grocery store and say, wow, this one has a lot more vitamin K than another one does, and so therefore I'm going to make my choice on the basis of that. People are choosing in the leafy green thing based on what it tastes like. Okay, if it looks good, they'll try it, and if it tastes good, they'll keep coming back. So the nutritional content, I'd love to be able to say, wow, even on the antioxidant thing, this thing has twice as much antioxidant as another one does. I know that's within the range of the genetics of the crops that we're working on, so we can play those kind of games, but it doesn't wash as well. Yeah. Yes. Right, so the first question is, do we have a breeding program to address this? We're working in cooperation with seed companies because they're interested as well. They see this as a growing industry. And so that whole equation hasn't been worked out, but I see that happening because the opportunity is huge. And it has to be huge in order for seed companies to pay attention to this. So creating a seed line just like they did for organic or to some degree for microgreens, so you can go through most of the catalogs and they'll show you something that's good for microgreens. But for doing it for CEA is kind of like another version of that. And your second question was about no place is bug-free. I 100% agree with you. I sort of like that one thing, I hope it never rains kind of deal, okay? But in 12 years, we've not had a bug issue. I don't know. It'd be wonderful if somebody could figure that out. Is it because we're using a limited spectrum? Because bugs do respond to that. Leaving out infrared might be one of the reasons why they can't see very well. Being indoors, they typically want to go from dark to light in a lot of cases. Does that play any role in it? I just don't know. But doing this essentially ex sunlight, I think, has a lot to do with that. Also, there's no soil. So everything that we've tried to do in the design of this has been somewhat IPM oriented. How can we put up as many barriers to bugs as possible? So I can't tell anyone that it won't happen. I do know this, that turning things over that quickly makes it rather difficult for bugs to establish themselves. And bugs can come from other places. We had a shore fly fungus gnat. They showed up, but quickly disappeared. We identified the drain that was responsible for that. So I don't know. It's great question. Don't know the answer to that. That's something else that perhaps someone can look into. Yes, sir, in the back.
Do you label your products as airborne to ground? How do you label the package?
Hasn't been decided yet.
I have a question.
Yes, sure.
You mentioned that you collect lots of data while you're producing these crops. Collecting data is really easy. Do you have an effective way to use those data to improve your production practices?
Yes, so we're producing algorithms as fast as we can. Dealing with the amount of data that we have coming in is something that you'll all be pleased to hear. We like to hire people to help us with that who understand plants. And I see this, we have three people on board right now that's a big part of their day is what did we learn from the data that came in. But massaging this data, we're still learning exactly how do we hunt out the pieces we want without kind of ignoring things that would be more meaningful. So research in that particular area, when you know as much as we do about the environment that the plant was grown in, and now throw in the physiology of that plant, adding that information to it, now you have a data set nightmare, okay? So learning how to mine it, it will be very important in the future, at least for operations like ours. Thanks. Yes. I think that there is. It's a place that we haven't gone. I mean, commercial expediency says we're learning about this. There's lots of opportunity. There's plenty of demand. So there's a lot of factors that go into the decision of... Yes, right, it is. There is a sweeter spot, okay? It's called pot. And so, you know, I assume there'll be a certain amount of research that'll go into it. They'll look very much like this. Okay. So how do you get the maximum THC and the most impact out of it? And all the other organoleptic, I guess, could still be applied to it as a drug. Perhaps there are other drugs. So I think there are lots of other crops that could be looked at. I think trees and vines, this, at least our approach, doesn't really lend itself very well to that. So I'm not, but you know, we're very inventive about what we do indoors. So I was just at the AERGC meeting that was combined with N0101. Those people work in greenhouses growing all kinds of things and maintaining them. So I think controlled environment agriculture has quite a nice future. Just don't know how far it'll go. Yes.
Oops. Any other questions? Thank you, Ed.
You're welcome.